nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Okay, and first we're going to recap what we talked about on Friday. Then derive the beam propagation method in more detail than we did on Friday. And then also talk about the very close connection that the beam propagation method has to the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. And then I'm going to talk about basically three different strategies for solving the BPM that also apply to nonlinear Schrodinger equation. So basically a fast Fourier transform-based approach, a uniform spatial grid approach, and then what we call a finite element approach. And then I'll start explaining the finite element method, although you won't be able to finish that discussion today. And then I'll also talk about perfectly matched layers and why those are important. Okay. So just in terms of what we did last time, it was mainly on FFTW and then an application, namely beam propagation method. So we said basically that FFTW has a big advantage in terms of executing fast Fourier transforms very quickly for like all kinds of architectures. And it's based on the idea of generating individual codelets for different steps of the fast Fourier transform process and then planning that out in advance and then using that customized set of codelets in order to run things at optimal speed. And there's like different interfaces that you can use to access that, both like kind of the basic 1D interface and then like both specialized interfaces in 1D as well as like generalized 2D and 3D strategies without going into all the details. Obviously, that was discussed last time. And then we use that to help solve the beam propagation method. But Justice asked me at the end of last class, like, you know, how did I end up writing the code in that way? Because like I didn't explain all the details of how I went from the basic derivation of the Helmholtz equation to BPM specifically. So that's what we're going to do today. Okay. So I'm going to assume you guys are totally on board with the Helmholtz equation at this point. Is there anybody who is confused where that's coming from? Okay, cool. All right. So the, like I said last time, the main approximation beam propagation method is to assume that our solution looks like this. So it's basically phi, so some slowly varying envelope function, times this e to the minus j beta z. And so this is essentially assuming that most of the spatial variation is along z direction and that it looks kind of like a complex exponential, right? So constant amplitude, but then like rapidly oscillating phase. Okay. So that's what this embodies, right? And then phi should have relatively weak x, y, and z dependence. And then basically just plugging in this solution into the Helmholtz equation gave us this sort of equation. And compared to last time, I just wanted to clarify that, strictly speaking, there should be a z hat dotted into this derivative. Okay, so this actually becomes like a d phi dz here. Okay? So if we write this equation on the board now, so we have minus little Laplacian of phi plus 2i beta z hat dotted into the gradient of phi equal to k perpendicular squared times phi. Okay. So this kind of like our starting point for BPM. Now we're going to say that this is like just d phi dz, okay? Which hopefully makes sense, right? Because we're just dropping the derivatives here because this is only z dependence, right? And then for this part, we're actually going to basically expand this explicitly to say that this is minus d squared by dx squared. And then same for y and z. Okay. But now that we've already lost like the rapid z dependence in psi, which was associated with this complex exponential, then we can expect that this will be relatively weak. And so we can actually drop the second derivative in z because there's already this first derivative in z. So that's going to dominate the overall z dependence of the envelope function, not the overall psi, but just of phi, right? So that's a key distinction. So hopefully you can tell when I write on the board whether I'm writing phi or psi. Right now I'm just writing phi. So now we have basically like this transverse spatial derivative or Laplacian, okay? And then plus 2i beta times d phi dz is equal to k perp squared times phi, okay? And so now we can actually rearrange everything to be in, basically with d phi dz on the left-hand side. Okay, so we have 2i beta d phi dz, and then we have this derivative. So the Laplacian in the transverse direction of phi plus k perpendicular squared times phi. And then we can divide everything by 2i beta. So then we're left with d phi dz is equal to, this should probably be a minus sign here. So then this becomes plus I over 2 beta, and then this Laplacian of phi, and then plus k perp squared phi by 2 beta times I times phi. Okay, so hopefully you guys can read that. And so here I just wrote this equation over again, right? So in case you have trouble reading this part. Here's the key equation or the key result. Okay. And so like obviously this still looks a little bit messy. So what we do at this point usually is we kind of define like all the stuff that's going in front of phi on the right hand side to be operators. Okay. And so we get two operators. One is just basically like a phase, like introducing a phase, right? So this is impacting like our phase from before here, right? So this is in addition to this phase, we get an additional phase associated with k perpendicular squared. And so we call this W, okay? So we're defining W to be this expression right here. Right, and then I'm just going to write it again as I times k perp squared divided by 2 beta. And then here, we're circling all of this stuff. So this is all the derivative information. And so then we're going to call this u. And so u is equal to I over 2 beta Laplacian. Okay. So hopefully that makes sense, like why we're trying to write it like this, because now we can just write d phi dz is equal to u plus w times phi, okay? And now u and w are just generalized operators at this point. And the key thing that you'll notice here, and we'll talk about it more in detail in a few minutes, is just that this kind of looks like a kinetic energy term, like from quantum mechanics, like in Schrodinger's equation. And then this looks like a potential energy term. Okay, and so we'll come back to that again. But one thing we know about this problem is like this is basically a derivative of phi is equal to phi times some operator. So we can call this like just like phi prime equals like a phi, for example, right? But we already know the solution to that sort of problem, which is just like phi of c plus delta z is equal to the exponential e to the a delta z times phi of z, right? It's a very obvious solution, I hope. So we know that we have like a generalized solution. Now what makes this a little non-trivial, however, is that A is not just some fixed constant in general, right? But A is an operator. So now we're exponentiating an operator or like more likely actually matrix. And before I go into the details of how would we solve that, like, numerically, let me also mention the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. Okay. So, you know, this set of choices for U and W are not, like, the only ones you could ever make. But, like, what's important is, like, we're now establishing a framework in which you have, like, kind of a kinetic energy term and then a potential energy term, and then you're solving this, like, with these exponential-type solutions. Okay, so if you're thinking about, like, a propagation of a pulse in a fiber, actually, that's, like, very relevant to some of the people in this room, actually, then there are two, like, really key pieces of physics here, and then maybe a third one, which is not as exciting, but still there. So the first piece of physics that's significant is the dispersion of the waveguide. So in other words, most fiber optic waveguides will inevitably have some sort of, like, wavelength dependent dispersion effect. And that's captured here by this U term, right? So this can be thought of as kind of like the kinetic energy we saw earlier, but this is in time instead of space. Okay, so that's obviously an important distinction. And then this beta 2 is basically derived from the second derivative of the dispersion relation that relates frequency to wave vector, right? So if you haven't seen that before, that's where that comes from. So I guess you could write that beta 2 is equal to, d squared omega by dk squared, something like that. Right, so clearly if omega equals ck, that's just zero. But most fibers have a non-trivial or non-vanishing dispersion in general. Although you could potentially find what's called a zero dispersion point or a low dispersion point where beta 2 is small. Okay, and then the second term that's significant here is this Kerr nonlinearity. And so this acts like a potential energy. And so you can see that these have the opposite signs. So these two are going to kind of fight against each other. If you have, like, what's called a dispersion compensating fiber, then ideally you'd want these two effects to roughly cancel each other out. Okay. And so the point is, if you are able to determine, like, what is beta 2 and then what is the Kerr nonlinearity in the specific fiber, associated with a specific, like, pulse intensity, then you can potentially find an operating point at which these two cancel. Now, things are made a little more complicated by the fact that any real fiber will have a non-zero loss, and that's captured by this minus alpha. So this just captures, like, the natural decay of the signal over distance. Although usually, most fibers nowadays can propagate for many kilometers, so you might not have to even worry about that too much. But I guess the point is, like, you can have both potentially, like, terms that are just, like, linear operators for the potential, or you can have things that are nonlinear operators, right? So this is a very general framework that we're developing here. But if this is nonlinear, okay, so W has the dependence explicitly on phi, that makes things harder to solve numerically. And so what's going to happen is, like, you need to know both the initial phi and then the phi at the end, like the phi of z plus h, I called it, or where h is equal to delta z. But you don't actually know that in advance, right? Because you're trying to start with w of z and then use that to propagate to the phi of z plus h. Does that make sense? And I'll explain that in more detail later. But basically, you need to know both in principle, but you don't know both. So basically, the strategy here will be to evaluate everything iteratively. So you'll basically use everything that's evaluated at your starting point as kind of your initial guess, and then you can work backwards and then see, like, how does that change this W of Z plus H, and then start over again. And basically, like, after a few iterations, usually this would converge for most normal values of the different parameters, like beta 2 and kappa. Like, unless you were in some extreme regime where you had extremely strong nonlinearity, maybe. That makes sense, or any questions so far? Okay, cool. All right, so how do we basically solve this formal exponential here, right? So clearly, since we said that this was like an A was equal to U plus W, then we'll write U plus W. And then we'll say that we have a step size H for delta Z, and we'll probably want it to be small, okay? And so we'll write it like this. And so if we know that U and W commute with one another, right? So it doesn't matter if you take phi and then you operate on U with U and then W, or W then U, if you get the same result, then they commute, right? So in other words, if U W phi equals W U phi, okay, if that's true, then we can also rewrite this exponential of U plus W as a product of two separate exponentials, right? So we can write this as e to the h u, e to the h w times phi.
Why is that important?
Well, basically, we want to not have to add the operators before we exponentiate them, because otherwise that makes things painful computationally.
Right. But my question is, why do they have to be commutable?
Why do they have to commute? So I guess the point is, if they don't commute, then you can't write that in general. Like, that won't be correct.
So yeah, I'm asking for the mathematical reason.
Oh, what's the mathematics? Okay. So, I mean, I think you could probably expand this. So you could write that you have 1 plus HU plus W. Oh, maybe I need more space to write that. Let me start here. So if we say e to the h u plus w, then that becomes 1 plus h u plus w, and then plus 1 half h squared u plus w squared. Okay, and so on. All right, so we have a lot of terms here. And then if we write e to the h u, e to the h w, then that becomes like 1 plus h u plus 1 half h u squared, plus dot, 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 and then, sorry, times 1 plus hw plus 1 half hw squared, dot, dot, dot. Okay, so we get something like this. And I think the point is, this will look like u squared plus uw plus WU plus W squared. And then this will look like 1 plus HU plus HW, so there's no problem there. And then plus HU, H squared, UW plus U squared plus W squared. Okay, and then for the cross term, we don't have a WU, I don't think. Oh, okay, I see. But there is a 1 half associated with this. So this becomes like 2 UW. Sorry. Okay, so the point is, you get a 2 UW here, whereas here you get UW plus WU. Right, so then if these commute, then those are the same. If they don't commute, then they're not the same, basically. That's what it comes down to.
So basically, for such a small h, is it that important? Because,
well, it can be important, especially, you know, if the operators are creating like large values. So even if you had a small h, if u and w were effectively expanding to large values, which is possible, especially in the Fourier basis, that's likely that they would expand to large values, then basically I mean, you could potentially get away with them not commuting, but then maybe each has to be so small for accuracy that it's like extremely costly numerically. So it's not like an ideal method.
So physically speaking, what does the commutability of U and W mean?
What does it mean? It means basically that U and W are separate observables. So if we go back to like what these things are, right? So this is, we said it's kind of like a kinetic energy. And then this is kind of like a phase term, right? So if these can be observed separately and they're both like good quantum numbers of the system, then we can say that these would probably commute. And in general, like, you probably know, like in quantum mechanics, like if you just think in broad terms about kinetic and potential energy, like oftentimes those will commute with each other, right? Because those are separate parts of the energy of the system. Like it's very clear in like classical mechanics, you have like a well-defined kinetic and potential energy, like for a ball that's like rolling on a hill, right? As it rolls down, you get a transfer of energy from potential to kinetic, but at every given time, the total energy is conserved and each of the individual energies are their own observables. And so that usually holds true in quantum as well. But so I'm not saying that's true in every single instance, but it should be true in both of these cases at least. Okay, so it depends on what you put into U and W, whether they commute. But I think for both of these, they do. Okay, so going on to this expansion here. So another thing is, like, if we know that U and W commute, we're just going to kind of go with that, then you can actually rearrange this a little bit and then write two exponentials for HU and then basically arrange them symmetrically. Okay, so why would you do that? Like, so this is the idea of the split step method for evaluation. And I think it's just empirically, this is usually a little bit more accurate than just kind of the direct approach here. Okay, so this diagram kind of illustrates it. So basically the point is that we start with some solution here on the left-hand side. Okay, some phi of xz. And so this can either be given as a source, or it could be a result of a previous computation, right? But we have actually assume that we already know this somehow. And then we have some propagating medium, and then we're propagating a distance h. And by assumption, h is probably small, okay? And we're trying to figure out what is phi over here. So this is the unknown. And so now what we're saying is that first we're going to propagate only half a step with the Laplacian to h over 2. Up here, okay? Right, so we're only evaluating this U operator for half the step, h over 2. And then right at this point, then we evaluate the phase shift that would occur over this whole distance from here all the way over to here using this value and then this value that we have so far. Okay, so we're kind of incorporating some of this information. And then we propagate the rest of the way with the Laplacian. So we propagate the other, like, h over 2 distance, okay? So I hope that makes sense, like, what I'm doing. So I'm not saying, like, this is the only way you can possibly do it, right? It's just that in what I've seen, like, a lot of researchers have found that this is more effective to do it this way as opposed to having to manually, like, just do one and then the other and then the other, and going back and forth mechanically. So this is just in order to improve the accuracy. There may be some theoretical argument for that too, which I think we might want to look at later as we try it out a little more. But does this make sense, like what I mean by split step? Okay. Cool. Yes, Roman.
Any good methods on guessing the C plus H solution based on geometry?
To guess it? Well,
I mean, the next step, because right now we're saying that we evaluate it by setting it the same as the initial phi of z, right?
Well, I think effectively what we're doing is we're just assuming that if there's like a z variation, then it's mainly associated with this e to the minus j beta z. and then any other C variation is weak. So that's kind of the assumption that's embedded. Now, of course, you could come up with another method and assume a different Z variation, and then that would obviously produce a different set of equations and so on. Right?
Right.
Does that make sense?
But in iterative solution, you're assuming some kind of a, because you don't know the value of at Z plus H.
Right.
So you're assuming it equal to be the value at Z, right? Is that the kind of
Well, so if you're talking about like the nonlinear case, like with the nonlinear Schrodinger equation,
right.
Is that what you mean?
Well,
yeah. So for the linear approach, if your solution really conforms to that assumption, there's usually no problem. The nonlinear case is a little trickier. So then that's why you have to perform the self-consistent iteration. And then the point about that, if we go back again here, was that we don't initially know what our phi at Z plus H is. So we basically use the information we have at the beginning of phi of Z to basically just guess that W will be unchanged from Z to Z plus H, right? So if H is small, that's not an outrageous assumption, hopefully. And then we basically propagate based on that guess. And then we can work backwards to figure out, like, what should W have really been, right? After we get a phi, then we say, okay, so if we know our initial guess for phi of Z plus H, like, we can call it, like, phi 1 of ZH, then what should W of Z plus H be? Propagate again, and then we will propagate the second time we get a phi 2 of Z plus H. And then we can compare it to the previous solution. If after a few iterations, phi of n plus 1, right? So we're basically saying like W of Z plus H equals W of H of Z, sorry. And then this leads to phi 1 at Z plus H. And then this leads to W, call it, I guess, W2 at Z plus H from this. And then this leads to phi 2 of Z plus H, right? So we keep going in this iterative process back and forth. Maybe I should have created a diagram to illustrate this better. But the idea is, like, if the difference between, like, successive iterations of phi compared to the absolute value of phi becomes very small, then you can say that that's very self-consistent and then just cut it off. And it just depends on your tolerance for error, how much you have to do that.
My question was whether we can intelligently guess a solution other than it being equal.
Oh, is there any better guess than
right.
It being equal?
Right.
Well, I mean, BPM basically is assuming that there won't be a huge variation over small steps. But, you know, certainly if you felt like that was not a good guess, then you may want to re-examine, is BPM really the best method in that situation, because that's basically what it's assuming, right? So it's not actually that great for every single problem. Certainly, it's certainly not like a completely general tool. But what's nice about it is it's very fast and efficient. And for some problems, it works great. And other problems, like, you should probably never even try, right? So basically, if you have anything like, let's say, like, you had a photonic crystal cavity waveguide, right? Like, BPM is probably not, like, a good strategy. Like, if there's, like, basically a periodic variation, like, every step along the propagation, like wavelength scale or less, if there's, like, massive variations in epsilon. Because, like, obviously, if you had a waveguide, like, let's say that it was, like, a bunch of rods, okay? Then you start off with like a W of Z here, and then you have W at Z plus H over here, right? And maybe objectively speaking, H is very small. Maybe it's only like 100 nanometers, right? But when you like go from inside of this rod to outside of this rod, there's like a huge jump in the phi, right? So the so-called envelope function is actually varying very rapidly. And so that's breaking kind of the cardinal assumption of your method, which was that the second spatial derivative is very small, right? Because like it can't change like a very massive amount without like having a large second derivative probably. So basically the point is like there are just some problems where this is just not going to work, honestly. So I'm not selling this as like kind of a miracle solution to everything. But like I said, it is very fast. So that's really its key redeeming feature. And so if your problem conforms to the assumptions that are embodied in it, then it's very good. And so it's used very widely, like for understanding like telecoms and like fiber communications. And I think that there will be at least at some point, like again, an ECE 614 on like fiber optics and fiber communications that will probably heavily employ this sort of methodology. Okay, so any other questions? So, moving on now. So, yeah, like I said, there are a few different strategies we can use to actually solve what's happening, like, in kind of like a single Z. Okay? Like, when you have inhomogeneous dielectrics. Right. So, basically what we're saying is that we're gonna have, like, some sort of, waveguide. Maybe it looks like this if we write n as a function of x, okay? Right, so it's like a small rise in refractive index, like right in the middle, right? And so that's where you have your index guiding and confinement. And basically we're saying like within each of these layers, we want to solve for the modes like laterally, whether it's 1D or 2D lateral directions. And we can either use a fast Fourier transform approach, which is kind of what we alluded to last time, or we can just use a uniform spatial grid, or we can use what's called the finite element method, which we haven't seen before. And I'll explain that more in a few minutes. Okay, so for the fast Fourier transform, like what's the advantage of that? Like if you look at this operator, you see that this is a second spatial derivative, right? So of course, like evaluating a spatial derivative might seem like a real pain, but what's nice about this is that if you're in the Fourier domain, then the second spatial derivative just becomes an algebraic problem, right? So in the Fourier domain, then this spatial derivative just brings down like the overall wave vector of the system. And this might be like a conserved k perpendicular plus a reciprocal lattice vector g. Okay. And so then if we say now that this is equal to basically I times k plus g, then that means that this operator, which we called u, is going to become this. So minus j over 2 beta times k plus g perpendicular squared. Okay. And so what that means is if we're evaluating this in the Fourier domain, we still may want to do stuff in the spatial domain. So we actually are going to be transforming both into and out of the Fourier domain using a fast Fourier transform. So if you remember the presentation from last time, I showed you a code snippet which had like both a fast Fourier transform and then inverse fast Fourier transform, right? So that was basically like the way that I was trying to evaluate kind of the phase associated with this kinetic energy term by basically transforming into Fourier domain, evaluate this, and then transform back. Okay, and so you'll end up doing a bunch of fast Fourier transforms back and forth. So that's one strategy. Now, I mean, the problem is like Omar was asking earlier about like, oh, so these, what's in the exponential should always be small, right? So unfortunately for this strategy, this could be very large, right? So especially if you're including like a lot of like, different, spatial components, right? So basically you go to very high reciprocal lattice vector G, then this G can increase without bound quadratically, okay? So obviously if you're trying to do like a million different wave vectors in 2D, right, like 1,000 in each direction, then this is going to become mind-bogglingly huge. Now, I mean, does your solution couple to the 1,000th component in each direction? I mean, in a lot of problems, there's not much coupling, right? So that may just tell you, like, okay, we want to reduce the number of wave vector elements we couple to. But that still brings up the basic dilemma that if you want to have a relatively fast approach, then you have to sacrifice accuracy somehow, right? So you have to either reduce the number of components or like increase H in order to have a solution in a reasonable amount of time. So it eventually gets to the point where it may not really give you a very rapid solution compared to some other techniques that we'll look at later. So you have to be careful about how you do this and like when you do this, right? So basically the situations where this might be useful are where you have basically one strong Fourier mode that dominates your structure. And then everything else is like very small, right? All the higher order Fourier components, or maybe just a couple of like lower harmonics are significant, right? So this is actually a fairly good candidate structure. So if we were to make the length of this waveguide region about one half of our overall thing, then we can call this our duty cycle, like the range at which we have elevated index values. And we can say our duty cycle is one half. And so then that means that there's like a domination by the first reciprocal lattice vector, like the so-called G1, right? So G1 dominates here. Or if we had something like where F was 1/4, then we could say that G2 dominates, right? So if it's like 1 over a small integer, like in length, and then everything else is uniform, then that's a pretty good candidate for fast Fourier transform. But something that's very complicated is probably not such a good candidate, right? So if it looked like this, and then this, and then this, and then this goes on for a long distance, like this is really a bad candidate for that kind of analysis. Okay, I guess it could be worse, but it's not the greatest. Okay, so the other approach is like, okay, we feel confused and concerned about the fast Fourier transform, so we can just do a uniform spatial grid, right? And this is very similar to what we saw earlier when we were solving Poisson's equation, right? So this is just basically the discrete approximation to the Laplacian in 2D, okay? And 1D, of course, it's the exact same thing we saw before as well, right? And now we're basically saying that, like, we have an N by N grid. So we have connection, like, in the X direction between phi I minus 1, phi I and phi I plus 1, and then the Y direction from phi I minus N to phi I plus N, okay? So this gives rise to, like, the banded diagonal sort of matrix equation where our matrix here, A, would basically have like 5 diagonals associated with like offsets of plus or minus 1 and plus or minus N, right? So if you don't mind, I'll erase this. And so, like, the direct spatial solution then we get something like A is equal to minus 4, 1, 1, minus 4, 1, 1, minus 4, 1, 1. And then we have some other band off here, offset by N. Or I guess there's N minus 1 zeros. Right, so it's the same distance each time. And then we also have this N minus 1 zeros here, and 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, then a bunch of zeros. Does that make sense? So this is very similar to what we saw earlier. Okay. Yeah. So what happens though if this is like a really big problem? Right? Like you still have to like now construct a huge matrix. So that's not really that great. So like let's say that we're interested in looking at a problem where we have basically a very large multimode core. And let's say that this core is large enough to be macroscopic, okay? But, you know, there's interesting physics happening, right, like at the boundaries of the system. So in particular, like, if we have a large core, like let's say that it's a 2D core, this our core, and let's say that this is like 200 lambda, okay, 200 physical wavelengths that are operating wavelength rate. So if lambda is 1.55 microns, maybe the diameter of this core is like 300 microns or so, right? I mean, that's not really even that big. I mean, that's three times the thickness of a human hair, but it's kind of big, like from optical simulation perspective, right? And then maybe this is another like 50 lambda or something, the cladding, right? Okay, so what happens now? Do we need to have like in both like the X and Y directions, like 10,000 grid points or more, right? So we don't go below the Nyquist frequency, right? Because then that's going to be like 100 million like grid points, like for each value of Z, right? And then we have to do Z plus H, Z plus 2H. So this is going to add up to like a real pain in the neck computation, right? So I'm not saying that's impossible to do, and it's actually more possible now than it ever has been. But still not good to burn huge amounts of cycles, especially if any of you want to graduate, right? So you want to have something that's like as efficient as possible. So that leads us to the finite element beam propagation method strategy. And so now basically what we're going to say is we want to be able to capture like when we have rapid spatial variations at certain like key positions, but not have to perform like a full solution like in every little spatial domain at the same time. So we want to basically have the freedom to kind of vary the fineness of our sampling. And then that's what finite element is basically designed to do. And so in 1D, like finite element is a fairly straightforward generalization of the uniform grid. Okay. So now in 1D, all we say is that instead of having basis elements that are spaced uniformly, okay, so I'm going to erase everything now. I'm going to say instead of having uniformly spaced basis elements, we're going to have non-uniformly spaced elements. Okay, so before everything was like this, so it's a uniform grid, and there's no option to change this. All you can do is change the overall spacing. But if any small features are occurring over here, then you have to sample everything over here. So now we're going to say, like, okay, let's say all the important features are here, and then we can space this out more and more. And so then we have a sample here and then here, right? So we change the spacing, like maybe an order of magnitude, maybe even more if we need to. And this just in 1D, right? And in finite element method, like after you select that grid, then you construct a solution within each of the little elements that make up that grid, right? And so usually like the form of the solution you're going to pick in each of these elements is going to be like a what's called a tent function. And so it might look like this, and then this, this. So in 1D, it just looks linear, okay? But then in 2D, then it can look a little less trivial. So it can look something like this, right? So it can look like a little pyramid, right? So this is like the solution. This is like our F or whatever. And then this is like the X and Y axes. And so now we're saying, for something like this, this is just an illustration from Obaya's book. We're basically dividing the spatial domain into a set of like 2D triangles. Okay. So for 1D, it's like a very simple like set of like line segments of varying length. Here it becomes triangles, and then it becomes usually tetrahedra in 3D. And I mean, you could potentially even do like higher dimensionality using the same strategy. But I just said in general, the mesh has D plus one vertices. So 2D has three, 3D has four. Okay. And we just construct a 10 function within that support. Now, the really key aspect of this strategy is this allows us to transform our original problem to a linear algebra problem that looks like this, LU equals B. Okay. And then L is usually called the stiffness matrix. And the stiffness matrix tells you how much the different basis functions overlap. And then this is where choosing a good basis becomes really important. And that's why we usually pick either like triangles or tetrahedra or so on, because that tells us that we're going to have what's called a compact support, which means that L is going to be a very sparse matrix. So we're only going to have a few non-zero overlaps between different elements. So even if we have, like, let's say 100,000 different finite element grids, then the number of off-diagonal elements in each row or column is only going to be a few, like maybe it's three or four, and then almost everything else is zero. And that's why we talked about like doing sparse matrix solvers. This is where it can become very helpful, because if you have a compact support basis, then you can use that sparse matrix solver to basically solve for this unknown U directly, without having to directly invert LU explicitly, which, like we established before, would take like an N cubed time, which is very time-consuming when you're talking about 10 million elements. Of course, you know, most of the methods we've talked about in this class are not necessary if you're dealing with trivial problems. But I assume you guys want to do like groundbreaking research. So that's why I go over this. And I should also mention here that B is integral of your PDE with respect to the basis. Okay, so, and you can oftentimes write B as what's called the mass matrix times like some F, which is another representation of the PDE before any integration with respect to the basis. Okay. So there are slightly different ways to formulate this. Like, so this is actually something we'll go into more detail on Wednesday. So I don't expect you to understand like all the details of how do you construct L, how do you construct B at this point. But basically, the point for now is that U is our solution, and we're basically trying to use the sparse matrix solver to give us U without explicitly inverting this, like perhaps using an LU factorization method, for example. Okay. And then before I go into any more details, let me just say, like, what are the really key advantages, right? So certainly, I think I made clear that spatial flexibility is one, because you can make elements big when you want them to be big, when there's not much interesting happening in that region, or you can make them very small. And so if you have a system where like there are orders of magnitude variation in the size of different features, this is very, very helpful. And then for speed, like I said, this L, if you have like a well thought out basis function, which is very easy to do because this has been known now for a couple decades at least, then you can construct something that's sparse, and then you can use a factorization method to help solve for U. And then that goes back to the lectures we had earlier in the class. So hopefully now that I'm talking about these like specific methods, it kind of makes sense why we went through all the pain and suffering earlier in this class, at least a little bit. Okay, any questions about that part? Okay, cool. All right, well, we don't have a lot of time, So I'm just going to briefly mention perfectly matched layers. So the reason why we have this here mentioned briefly is that if you have some sort of waveguide, okay, like this, then we know that maybe most of our field is concentrated in here, but maybe it's not completely terminated at the boundaries of our computation, right? Because in principle, even if it decays exponentially, it has some non-vanishing amplitude at the edges, okay? Now, we don't want to make the simulation have to require a really, really huge like spatial domain in order to give an accurate answer. So we don't want to basically artificially impose perfect electrical conducting boundaries, right? Like to set all the fields to zero at the boundaries. And so instead we use perfectly matched layers. And perfectly matched layers are basically layers that have a perfect impedance match with the real spatial region that they surround. But they absorb everything that enters them. Okay, so that's really the key, both impedance matching and absorption at the same time. So should be for like every angle and polarization and wavelength. And so there are actually a number of different formulations of PML. So if you've seen it before, this may have nothing to do with the formulation you saw. So that's okay, because there are at least three that I'm well aware of. And actually, I think there's a fourth one being developed at MIT. But basically, let me just say that the first one was split field, and most people don't use that now, where you basically introduce an extra field. That's not ideal, obviously. And then there's uniaxial, which is more widely deployed. But actually, we're going to use what's called stretched coordinate PML, because this is more general. And so basically, we turn all of these spatial derivatives into something that's stretched by this transformation matrix A. And note that this is effectively equivalent to Obaya's formulation, but I just thought this was easier to understand intuitively. So basically, I've constructed this matrix A, which is diagonal matrix, and only stretches in the lateral directions by this complex factor. And then basically, it's this beta. Beta is always positive, and it depends on both the wavelength and the reflection and like some other material parameters in the system. And so then this N is just matched to like the surrounding dielectric environment. And so you don't have to worry about the implementation details at this point, but basically just to give you a general sense of like, you know, how do you kind of start formulating these problems in an intelligent way computationally? Okay. So you're on.
Probably don't have time right now, but if you already have observing materials on the boundary, then you have some kind of think of something else, right? Because you effectively you change the basis to imaginary basis, right? Z becomes J, you introduce imaginary component into Z, which in a phase it becomes a damping coefficient.
We're basically propagating in this direction, just to be clear. And then the PML is over here. So the idea is your waveguide and main propagation is here. And it's just you don't actually care about all the details of the boundaries here. You just know that there's like a small amount of radiation or loss. And so now what you're saying is, rather than try to compute it explicitly, we'll just let it go into PML so there's no back reflection. So that just becomes more realistic than putting like a hard boundary or perfect electrical conductor, which would give you a result that may not be physically accurate, especially if you had a tight constraint on your computational domain. Okay, so but I'll explain more about this method in the next class on Wednesday. So we're not done yet. But we're getting there. So Obaya's 2.7, 2.8 go into more detail.